Om Sahana Bhavatu, Sahana Bhunaktu, Saha Viryam Karavavahai, Tejasvina Vadhitamastu Ma Vidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Om Advayananda Rupasya, Advayananda Rupasya, Sadvayatvam Chadukkita, Sadvayatvam Chadukkita, Bandav Prokta Swarupena, Bandav Prokta Swarupena, Stitir Mukti Ratiryate, Stitir Mukti Ratiryate, Advaya Ananda Rupasya Sa Sadvayatvam Chadukkita Bandha Proktaha Swarupena Stitihi Muktihi Iti Iryate. There's a beautiful quote in the Bhashya here that is kind of used to introduce the verse, but I like the quote so much I'll just read it to you. Tad Brahma Aham Iti, Tad Brahma Aham Iti. That I am Brahman, right? Tad Brahma Aham Iti, or I am that Brahman. Nyatwa, having known that I am Brahman, Sarvabandhaihi Muchate. One is released from all bondage. So knowing that I am Brahman, one is released from all bondage. And so here, in this verse, Advaya Ananda Rupasya, for the one whose rupa, in this case, rupa, especially at the end of a compound, the word rupa can mean swarupa, one's nature, or just form, one whose form is, or one whose nature is, at the end of a compound, unless it's something like namarupa, name and form. The rupa means one whose nature is Advaya Ananda, non-dual Ananda. Non-dual, I've been talking about what is really the nature of Ananda, is your being unimpeded by any type of duality or tension. Really, if you think unimpeded by duality, subject-object, unimpeded by raga-dvesha, unimpeded by any type of desire, any type of wanting anything to be different, which just allows the mind to enjoy a shanti and, in a sense, be kind of invisible. The mind and body and sense organs become instruments, usable instruments, not problems, not problematic instruments, just well-functioning instruments, right, which are not calling attention to themselves. Have you ever had like some sort of an instrument that doesn't quite work? It doesn't, like a garden instrument. It doesn't quite work. It doesn't do the job. It has to be fixed. You have to fiddle with it. You have to give it all kinds of attention, as opposed to an instrument that was working perfectly. So what about when your mind is not riddled with raga, dvesha, and all of these fears and insecurities and complexes that always need to be cared for? They take a lot of time, a lot of care. They absorb your mind. They absorb all of your attention. They're kind of like a vortex. They absorb, they just suck you right into it because of the pain or the tension or the whatever it is, So what if when your mind is free from that, then it just becomes a working instrument that you use. Just like your sense organs. If your sense organs are working, say you have 20/20 vision, you're not always searching for your glasses. Your eyes just work fine. Your ears are working fine. And so you use them. You don't really think about them. They don't call attention to themselves. And so hear this Advaya Ananda. Advaya means non-dual, one without a second. There is no second thing to interfere with you from the outside, and there are no parts in the inside to break down, and there's no parts from the outside to impact on you, you know? When we say non-dual, what we mean is one without a second, internally as well as externally. In fact, did you really understand the meaning of non-duality? In this era, it's become actually kind of a buzzword, and everybody has their own definition of non-duality. But within the Vedanta, the Advaita, non-dual, one without a second, means this. We take this experience of duality that we have, and we can divide it up into three types of duality, which are kind of all embracing. There are three categories of duality. For instance, we can divide the whole creation up into species, like there's dogs and there's cats and there's rocks and, you know, there's trees, and the trees have species within species within species. But there's groups. There are many divisions in this creation into groups or into sets, you know. If something is non-dual, there cannot be more than one set. There can only be one group, not two groups. There can only be one set, one species. Okay. But now the problem we have is, say there is, only exists one species of something, like one species of dogs, you know, German shepherds. There are only one species of dogs, non-dual, there's not two. But then, in that species, there's more than one dog, right? So in the one species of dogs, there exist many dogs. That's dual. So even though there's one species, there are many members to that species. So that's not non-dual now, right? And then we can say, okay, so there can be one species that has only one member. Now we have it, okay? But that one member has parts, like the one dog, you know, it has a head and it has paws and it has nails and it has bones and it has organs, and it can be divided up into a multiplicity of smaller and smaller and smaller parts. That is not non-dual. So when we're talking about non-dual, we're talking about one species, one member, and that one member has no parts. That's non-dual. Why I'm telling you this is because there are so many different concepts about non-dual. Like, for instance, often, at least at CIS and in some of the different spiritual communities, they think of non-dual as there is only one universe. One universe, you know. And it's interconnected. It's infinitely one, infinitely interconnected universe. That is non-dual. Now, say if in your teaching tradition that is what you mean by non-dual, that there is one infinitely interconnected universe, that is your definition of non-dual, and the student has to know that, you have to know that, and you're working off of that definition. But in the Advaita Vedanta, that is not the definition of non-dual. Non-dual means one without a second in terms of one species that has only one member, and that one member has no parts, right? That is non-dual. And that is your nature. The nature of the self is non-dual. It doesn't allow for a second thing, either internally or externally. There's not the non-dual Brahman and Maya, as though Maya is itself a second thing. That would be dual, right? And there's not my one non-dual self, from the standpoint of myself, it has many interconnected parts. No, there are no interconnected parts to the self. There is one non-dual, one species, one member, no parts. So that means there's nothing external that is not Brahman, there's nothing internal that is not Brahman, and Brahman, myself, has no parts. I don't have a right side or a left side or an up or a down. I don't have a happy side or a depressed side. I am simply what we call ananda, the Advaita ananda. What we say, as we've been talking about Advaita ananda, is because the meaning of the ananda is that unimpeded, just being me, the just simply being me without any external impediments or any external, you know, without unobstructed. The unobstructed being me. I talked about the lazy man samadhi of deep sleep. At least then the whole creation is there was in a manifest condition and not bothering you in any way. Right? And then Swamiji will go on and on about how everybody loves their sleep. How you get a really good mattress. You want to have nice warm blankets if it's cold outside. Why? So that you can just lay back, be comfortable, very comfortable, you know, and actually, just think what happens. You blot out everything, including everything you have identified with your as yourself, even the I thought, even the knower. Notice nobody in deep sleep that's saying, oh, isn't this the greatest deep sleep? I just love it when I'm asleep like this. There's nobody there. There is no manifest I. The manifest I, knower known relationship, all of this requires duality. It's a big, there's something to learn in this, that when you go to sleep, the knower known relationship is not there. The mind is not active. It's not functioning. Right? It's an unmanifest condition. And when the mind goes in unmanifest condition, there's no sense of see or seen, hear or heard, or think or thought. Nor are there manifest emotions. None of this is there. These things all belong to duality. They belong to the manifest creation, to the manifest jiva. So Bhagavan was in a way really, really kind. Yet, even though it's a natural expression, it's not Bhagavan says, oh, let me be kind to these poor creatures. Let's give them some deep sleep. It just happens that deep sleep is part of the creation and allows for our health, really, to just have that complete time out where I can just be myself with myself, even though there's no commentary. There's nobody there saying, oh, look, you're getting to be with yourself. Isn't that wonderful? You don't need that commentary. You don't need it. This lamp doesn't need to have somebody say, this is a lamp. You are a lamp. You are a lamp. Lamp. Okay? Chair. Person. These defining words are not necessary. They don't add anything to you. It helps us to communicate and all of that. You know, but I don't have to have somebody say or my mind saying to me, oh, now look, you just get to be with yourself. Ananda, this is what really Ananda is. And now Ananda arises because I've said that. That isn't true. When you're in deep sleep, that state of being, even though it's as though masked from the standpoint of the creation, from the standpoint of your body, mind, sense organs, it's as though masked because all of that's in unmanifest condition. You still are unimpeded. Your being, who you are, is not restricted or constricted or obstructed by the raga dvesha and the reactions that we have and the worries and the fears and all of these things that cause the mind to be restricted and then cause me to have not a free sense of self from the standpoint, free sense of just being me from the standpoint of the mind. Okay? And so, This self that I am, that they call Advayananda, Rupasya, for me, whose nature is really non-dual, and just unimpeded me, unimpeded fullness. It's exactly, I am what I want to be. That is my nature. My nature is what I'm seeking, actually. I'm seeking to be me. My mind is seeking to be me. My mind is seeking to get out of the way. It's seeking to get out of the way by going to sleep. Or it's seeking to get out of the way by trying to fulfill a desire because I have the experience of when I fulfill a desire for that moment, I am out of the way. All is well with me. I like to take walks in nature because in nature, the beauty of Ishvara, you know, is something that I can just resolve my mind into for a time. The tremendous beauty, that's why for meditation it's nice to take meditative walks in nature because my mind will just resolve into the beauty that allows me just to be myself. We call that self Ananda because Ananda is beloved, right? Because I am the most beloved. I am what I seek. But as an Ajnani, somebody who doesn't have self-knowledge, I'm seeking the experience of myself out here by creating a situation out here, or having a person love me out here, or going into beautiful nature out here to create a condition in my mind where I can just be myself fully, right? Where I can just feel, be with my own unimpeded being. That's what we mean by Ananda. So just understand a little bit more about that. This word Ananda, Sat Chit Ananda, as really, it's a lakshana for my own being. I am existence, I am being, which is consciousness, which is Ananda, fullness. You can check. Okay. But another way of saying that, Sat Chit Ananda, is Satyam Jnanam Anantam, where the Sat means Satyam, that which is existence itself, free from unimpeded existence that's not affected by past, present, or future. That is Sat. So my being is timeless. And my being is Chit, or Jnanam. Jnanam also means consciousness. It doesn't just mean knowledge, like a knowledge in a book. It depends on how the word is broken down. Just pure knowledge itself, pure consciousness. Jnanam, Satyam Jnanam. Or Anandam means Ananta. Satyam Jnanam Ananta. Ananta means that which is without end. Unimpeded. My Sat, the Sat, the Chit, is limitless, is non-dual. It has no end. That's absolutely my nature, is unimpeded me, without wearing the dress of the reactions and hurts and pains or desires of the mind. Right? For the standpoint of an Ajnani, somebody who doesn't have self-knowledge, what is ever going on in the mind is me. The reactions are me. The desires are me. The disappointments are me. The worries are me. And so I'm always experiencing myself through the lens of the mind, through the lens of my unconscious, through the lens of my emotion. So I never am just me, right? From the standpoint of a jnani, as one who doesn't have self-knowledge, myself and the mind are superimposed upon each other. So I'm always trying to clear out that mind. I have many ways to clear it out, listening to beautiful music, taking a walk in nature, the smile of a child, going to sleep, so many things I use, fulfilling a desire, I use to clear out that mind, even though it's a momentary clearance. It's a momentary sense of not being impeded or not being constricted. So I'm always trying to get that condition out of samsara. I'm trying to wring it out of samsara. For samsara cannot give it to me, really. It can only give me that temporary condition where, such a relief. The Bhagavan gave us deep sleep. But what has to happen is this Advayananda, which is my nature, I have to get back. And I can't get back by superimposing it onto an object and running after the object. That I'm not going to get it back. The only way I can get it back is through knowledge. So here, he's giving this nice verse talking about what is actually bondage and what is actually liberation. So he says, Sadvayatvam, the state of being dual, knower known, seer seen, I am one object within the creation. The sense of being what we call desha, kala, vastu, paricheda. That I myself, here this me, this conscious being that I am, is limited by time, it's limited by space. My time is only so much, right? I only take up so much space, a very small amount of space. I only exist for a short period of time, you know. And the way my body is, the way my mind is, the way my sense organs is, the way I am, is this body, mind, sense organs. That's the vastu. I am this object. This is what I got. This is what I got this lifetime. this is how I am, this is how much intelligence I have, and this is how my body looks, you know, and this is how much energy I have, and these are how good my sense organs are. You know, I have certain, this is the vastu, this is the thing, and this person here is a thing. And so this thing that we call this body, mind, sense organs is very different from your body, mind, sense organs and yours and yours and yours. You have certain certain wonderful qualities that I didn't get to have this time. You know, I wish I had that quality. So it's all very, very time bound, very spatially bound, and very bound in terms of the actual object. The actual qualities of this body, mind, sense organs. So it's totally limit, paricheda means this body, mind, sense organs is circumscribed by time, by space, and by the objectivity, the actual nature of it, right? And so this is what we call sadvayatvam, the being within duality of the Paramatma, which is advayananda, which in truth is limitless ananda, my being, this atma, which is limitless ananda, it as though is subject to this deshakala vastu paricheda duality. So that, this state of duality, ascribing this duality to that, who, the one whose nature is limitless ananda, and the state of suffering, dukkita, the state of being a sufferer. Dukkha, this is kind of nice. The word dukkha means like sorrow, and pain and sorrow. Dukkhi, comes from dukkhin, dukkhi, is the one who has the sorrow. So dukkha is the sorrow. Dukkhi is the one who has the sorrow. I'm a sorrowful person, I'm a dukkhi. Dukkita is the state of being a sorrowful person. The state of being a suffering person. So taking the one whose nature is really limitless ananda to be bound and circumscribed within duality as an object within duality, subject to time and space and quality, right? And then also being one who is a sufferer. I'm a sufferer. I am one who has sorrow, being one who has the sorrow. Bandha proktaha. That is called bondage. This ascribing the state of suffering and duality, deshakala vastu paricheda, this time space, quality duality, upon the one whose nature is limitless ananda, is called bandha. That is called bondage. Now, Swarupena stittihi, the abiding as your own self, swarupa, swarupa means one's own being, swarupena as one's own being, stittihi, just remaining abiding as one's own being, muktihi iti iriyate, that is called liberation. Just abiding as myself, getting to be myself, the self that I always am, abiding as myself, that is moksha. The bondage is taking this advaya ananda, this limitless self, which is pure ananda, the very being that I want to be actually bound and limited and a sufferer, subject to suffering. That is our bondage. Liberation is simply, what is called liberation, is simply being myself. Stittihi means just being rooted in swarupa, in my own nature. So that's wonderful. It's wonderful because I don't have to do anything to be myself. Swamiji used to joke a lot about, there was a time when macrobiotics, anybody ever get into macrobiotics? Yeah, I was really into it. I studied with Michio Kushi and all of this. I was really into that. So he knew that, so. And other people were doing yoga and macrobiotics and all of this stuff. So he would say things like, you don't have to eat sprouts. The sprouts are not going to liberate you. Brown rice is not going to help. So he would go through all of these type of things, you know. At the same time, so he would make fun. He was just relentless. He would make so much fun of all of the things that we were trying to do, you know, to liberate ourselves. We might not call it that, but that's what we were doing to become happy, to become whole, to become complete. I mean, I was really macrobiotic for quite a while. Yeah. This is just a little aside because it was so awful and so funny. when I first went to Boston, I went with some friends. I don't even remember who they were. This was a long time ago. It was probably 20. I went to Boston to study and live in the little commune of Michio Kushi, who was the head of the macrobiotics. So I went there, you know. And I had my own little room in this kind of communal set up, and they served all this delicious macrobiotic food. And so I was eating only that. I was very strict and doing all of that. And I'd been there for 3 or 4 days. I do not know what happened. I woke up one day, and my top lip, it was like a balloon. It was swollen up like a balloon. And one of the cooks told me, oh, you must have had too much salt. Now, anyway, I mean, I don't know why I thought of that, but it was really shocking. It was really, and I stayed with macrobiotics for 1 or 2 years, and it does make you feel, if you do it right, it does make you feel really fresh and really healthy. You know, and I did a lot of yoga also at one time. I'm not very good at it now. I respect yoga and I love yoga. And it makes you feel really good and balanced. So I wish I did yoga for an hour a day. At least I really wish I did. I just don't. I don't have it in me for whatever reason. I'm too busy or whatever excuse. But I love these things. I love eating well and having, you know, organic food and all of this, you know, and try to stay away from sugar and all of this and trying to keep my body really healthy. And definitely you feel much, much better. But you know what? You certainly don't feel liberated. You don't feel liberated. You just feel like you have a healthy body and your mind is much more clear and you have better energy. And we would say, and the Shastra would say in the Bhagavad Gita at the end of the last chapters of the Bhagavad Gita, when they're talking about the qualities of sattva, rajas, and tamas, you know, sattva being that which, you know, gives very clean, clear energy, a very clean, clear mind, and rajas, which gives agitation, like onions are really rajas, apparently. And tamas are those kinds of foods that make you fall asleep, and, you know, you eat too much, like on Thanksgiving or something, and all you want to do is sleep. Those kind of foods, it talks about all of those foods, and it says, you know, try to live a sattvic life. You know, get enough sleep. Don't sleep all of the time. Get enough sleep. Eat food that is primarily sattva. You know, go through all of this because it's what we call upayanishta. It gives you an upadi. It gives you a body, mind, sense organs, which is healthy and not calling attention to itself, you know, and is awake and sharp and clean and clear with clean energy so that you can sit with a mind that is not, you know, tamasic, you know, and not agitated and really be in a situation, in a condition to actually gain this knowledge. So it is one of, these are sadhanas. They're sadhanas for gaining a certain clarity in reference to the body and in reference to the nadis and the acupuncture lines and all of that, that everything is open and flowing and that you're eating food that allows the mind to be sharp. And we have all of these techniques for helping the inner child and following Dharma and so many things that we learn and we practice in order that my mind and my body can be available to this knowledge. They are not an end in themselves. They're an end in themselves in the sense of making you feel healthy and feel better, taking care of this. In India, they view this body as a temple, that you need to take care of it properly, you know. But we take care of this body properly and take care of our mind and follow Dharma and all of these types of things from the standpoint of a mukshu, so that I'm actually an adhikari, I'm qualified, my mind is qualified. It's not quite the right word, but we use it. qualified to gain this knowledge. So really, instead of qualified, we should just say, it is able to. So that my mind is able to gain this knowledge. So that my mind has a certain quietude and availability to be able to receive this teaching, which is really, as a pramana, as a means of knowledge, is simply pointing your mind to making you see, making you recognize this situation in reference to your subject-object differentiation, being able to really differentiate myself from the lenses that I'm always looking through. Recognizing, instead of taking myself to be this mind and all of my moods and emotions and qualities and all of this, taking myself to be that, because I'm only experiencing myself from the standpoint of the mind, I learn through these teaching methodologies that we use, I start to recognize myself as the subject who's the luminary, the one because of whom the mind is known. I see the difference between me, my own being, you know, and the experiences I'm having. I gain a little space. And then I can just recognize myself from my own standpoint. Recognize myself from my own standpoint. Be myself from my own standpoint. Not only knowing myself as superimposed on the body and the mind and the sense organs and the complexes, etc., etc., etc. These are just the manifold definitions of me for an Ajnani. These all have to be objectified so that then I can just recognize who I am without all of these costumes, right? And so this sadvayatvam, this state of duality, where I'm limited by the steshakala vastu, I'm limited by these three things, time, space, and the qualities and things that I'm experiencing, that limitation drops off. Because it becomes objectified. I realize that, in fact, I've never been that, never at any time. That drops off. The dukkita, the state of being in sorrow, it drops off. Now, there's something subtle to understand here, because what we would think here, this is common, for me it was common, but I think it's common for everybody actually, but for me it was a common thing, due to a misunderstanding. It's like, okay, that myself is free of sorrow. Okay? Well, let's just wait for that. Let's just wait for that to happen, okay? Now, this is the thing. That is not going to happen. Okay? That is already how you are. The problem is that there's this, from beginningless lifetimes, this identification with the state of mind. So you can have unhappy states of mind, and you will think, because the viveka and your knowledge is just, at that particular point, not complete, you know? So you will think that if the self is free of suffering, it has no sorrow. But I'm experiencing sorrow. So I'll really recognize that the self is free of sorrow when I have no sorrow. Now, when I say this, just listen to this language. I'll recognize that myself is free of sorrow when I have no sorrow. But I already have no sorrow. That's already who I am. And so if I say, when I recognize, you know, when I'll recognize myself as free of sorrow when I have no sorrow. No, you already have no sorrow. Okay? So the ahankara has slipped in there. The ahankara has slipped in to identify the self with the mind who is having sorrow. Now, your mind can, because I call it emotional lag time, once you really know yourself, I mean really know, not to just partially don't really know, the mind can still have sorrowful vrittis. It can still have agitations. The mind can. But you're not. You are not. So while the mind is having some sorrow or some agitation or some crankiness or whatever it is, something that you're not supposed to be having. If I really knew, I would not have this. Okay. That's so untrue. It's just simply false. You are not having sorrow. It is not your nature. So you have to recognize right now the one who has no sorrow. That is you. There is no such thing. There is no sorrow for you. The sorrow belongs to different states of mind, certain unconscious material that's coming up. The mind has sorrow. It has different states of joy. It has all kinds of the things on the continuum, you know, that are still taking place to whatever degree they are. Now we're talking about, instead of saying, you know, well, when I have no sorrow, then I'll recognize myself. Now, that's not correct. You have to recognize now yourself that has no sorrow, and then you can say, my mind has some emotional lag time, because even though I see very clearly that my being is always whole and complete, for Jnani, once you see this, my being, who I am, is always full, it is always complete, it does not go into and out of sorrow at any time. I'm always exactly the same. I adwaya ananda. I am non-dual. There's nothing else to come in and impede me. So the sorrow belongs to maya, to mitya. Okay. So the ahankara can get in the way there. But now what we have to realize is once we kind of remove that ahankara and we know, yeah, the mind is capable of suffering, having sorrow, it is capable of that because the mind has what we call an emotional lag time. You gain this knowledge, you recognize yourself, you understand Ishwar, everything starts to become more and more and more clear. But sometimes, you know, your mind just continues to act like an ajnani. Just awesome. Just acts like that. Even though you know. But it has been conditioned for, of course, this whole lifetime, but we can take it down to back to beginningless lifetimes, that the mind continues habitually, you know, to run after this or run after that, to kind of, even though I know this is true, still I want that. I need that to be happy. I know it's not true, but still, you know, I want that. That means I just need... Your mind needs time to absorb on very many different levels your this knowledge. There are many different levels. Your unconscious, I've said sometimes how I experience it, your unconscious and all of the things going on in the unconscious, a whole lifetime of experiences, have to rise up into your knowledge, into who you are now. And as they rise up into who you are now, then you can be with them. You can be with them. The one you are now can be with them in a way that is transformative. You can bring them back. You can bring those little bursts of ajnanam, those bursts of reactions and whatever, into who you are now. And that's our sadhana. When these things rise up, you know, especially they haven't risen up before, since you've had knowledge, they rise up now, and oh, wow, you know. But that's fine. They have to rise up. You have to be with them in a way. You have to enlighten them. And sometimes what's rising up are little children. All different ages are rising up from the unconscious. Layers and layers and layers of stored experiences are rising up from the unconscious into you, the one who has knowledge. Now, your knowledge has to be pretty thorough. It has to be pretty thorough. It has to know what's going on here. Because, say, it doesn't understand that. Then it'll say, and we used to all ask questions like this to Swamiji, and he'd always kind of laugh. And then answer us, you know. We'd be like, you know, Swamiji, it's like, I know myself. I really understand, Swamiji. I really know myself. But then it keeps getting covered over. And it keeps getting covered over. When will that not happen anymore, Swamiji? You know? But see, the thing is, yourself is never getting covered over. It's never covered over. when you say that, the reason you say that is because you've identified a state of mind, a shantavritti, with being yourself. You haven't recognized that your mind has shantavrittis, and it has emotional vrittis, and it has hurt vrittis, and it has reactionary vrittis, you know, all which are a product of self-ignorance. And when you gain knowledge, and you recognize yourself, and you even understand the mechanics of this, still the mind behaves as though you don't know. And then you think, well, if I really knew, my mind wouldn't behave that way. Well, true and not true. That's not really true. Because the mind, there has many levels to it. And there are many levels to the unconscious. And so when these things, you know, this kind of habitual ignorant behavior keeps rising up, you have to be patient. We use the example, Swamiji's used the example of the little, I used it the other day, the little baby walking around, takes one or two steps, falls on its bottom. Okay? And then it gets up a few more steps, falls on its bottom. And eventually it doesn't fall on its bottom anymore. It's kind of learned on that, you know. And so as some of these things, these problems we have, rise up, you know, into our mind with all of their emotion, you know, and wants and desires, that's okay, you know. It doesn't mean that you don't have self-knowledge. It means that there's an emotional lag time, and there are many parts of the mind and unconscious that need to come in, to rise into the consciousness of your knowledge. I think I told this story to some of you. I've heard this, I'm sure, before, but it's so meaningful. When I was when I went to India, and I was there for several years before I came home several times, but I was there for several years the first time. Second time I was there, for several years, and that's when I was really gaining this knowledge and all that. And so my mind had a certain wonderful shanti. Of course, I was getting 3 or 4 classes a day, and I was always being with Swamiji, and, you know, so I was enjoying an exalted state of shanti. Okay. Not too exalted, but good. It was fine. Mm-hmm. Right? So, well, then I get on the plane. I have to go home. I have to renew my visa, which is a little traumatic. But so I got on the plane, got home. I had to stay there for 6 months at home to get, to get some more money together and to be able to get my visa and all of that. And I ended up staying in where I used to live, in Berkeley, actually. And my parents were in Sonoma. And so I was meeting a lot of old friends and old relations and family members and all of that. And you know what happened? Reactions, feelings, hurts, ways of being that I had totally forgotten about started to rise up one after another, and I was flabbergasted. I was so shocked. This is all old material, just old material. It's just there is nothing in the new environment, in Swamiji's environment, that would trigger any of that stuff. And that's where with that recognition, and you know, the one other thing before I tell you the rest, the wonderful thing was, is that as they came up into who I was now, I was able to be with those in a way that they actually dropped off fairly quickly. But in order for them to drop off, they had to come into the me that is here now, the knowledge base that is here now, the buddhi that is here now. And I knew how to, at first I was so shocked, and I got back to my senses, kind of understood what was happening. And those things really, relatively quickly, not overnight, but relatively quickly, they just fell off because I no longer engaged or had those values or engaged in any of that in the same way. And so they just didn't have anything to hang on to, and they'd fall off. So that was kind of a dramatic example. But now for us, as you're gaining knowledge and you know yourself and still, emotions, reactions, traumas, they keep rising up. And they have to. They have to, because they have to come home. They have to come to you, to your buddhi, to the one who has knowledge, so that they can be, you know, so that they can be held in a way that will release them. They come into you who can be with them in a way and with a whole different set of attitudes, a whole different set of knowledge that allows those things to drop off. But until they come into the one who has knowledge now, the you that has knowledge, they just stay there dormant, waiting for an opportunity, for a trigger in the world, you know, to poke at that and bring it forward. So you have to learn to say, oh, you know, all right, now this is the next one. This is the next one we have to work on. It takes a while for the unconscious and the traumas and things we've picked up along the way. It takes a while for those things to work themselves out. Not 1 or 2 months. It takes several years, actually. The big ones will unload first. But then it's become more and more subtle. And there's another thing also, as the big ones are unloading, it's like there's this long well. A deep well, okay. And in this deep well of the unconscious, the ones that are on top come up first, you know. And they come up and a lot of, you know, stuff is released and there can be a lot of tears and you have to work through this thing and all, but it comes up and it goes. And then you feel so relieved. Your psyche is kind of just relaxed a little bit more than it had been before. And as it relaxes, kind of, now it's at the next layer. And it's a little stronger, though, so it can handle the next layer. And then that layer of unconscious material comes up. You know, and it comes up like in a torrent, and now you have to deal with that, and you know how to handle it. And there comes a time, as you're getting down, you know, a few layers into the well, that you actually welcome. You welcome these challenges as they come up because they're coming up into you, the one who has knowledge, the one who knows how to be with those things so that they can drop off and resolve, because you're not the same person. You're the same self, but the mind is oriented in a totally different way. And so the big ones in the well, one by one, release themselves and your mind gains more just natural baseline shanti. And more release, and more release, and more release. And pretty soon, and after a year or two, or three or four, you're down to the bottom of the well. And so the next, last great big one releases. Okay, so great. And so now I have just more shanti without all of that inner pressure because the big ones have released. But now, this is all kinds of little ones. You know, rising up. Little ways of being in the world, you know, that is not free. This need, this desire, not knowing how to be with my desires, you know, thinking that I need things to be in this particular way so that I can be happy. So there's a different level of maturity that starts taking place in the mind. And all of these little things go on and on and on and on and on. So how to be with that? Well, that's where the little rosebud story comes in. If you have the patience to watch a rosebud bloom, and the patience to enjoy every moment of that process, you know, to really be engaged in the beauty of that process, in the beauty of your own mind maturing in the light of this knowledge, to respect it, to engage in it, to appreciate it, to be grateful, and to watch your own mind, like that rose, becoming kinder and kinder to yourself and to others, to gaining more and more shanti as you tend to relax into your knowledge, you know, learning how to be patient, enjoying patience, being able to slow down to Bhagavan's speed, the Ishwar Srishti, Bhagavan's creation, to actually participate in that. All of these things are the little gifts that Ishwar is giving and giving and giving. If you're patient to appreciate it, if you're a patient to appreciate this end game of your jivatvam, this final growth, you know, in the light of your knowledge, the final, like the beautiful flowering, and to respect it and respect, you know, like how Bhagavan, how the flower unfolds naturally in its own way. You just have to provide the environment for it and it will beautifully unfold. And that's all we have to do, is provide that dharma, provide that environment, be committed to that, and be patient. Enjoy that process of unfoldment, you know. And look at all of the impurities, all of your angers and irritations, etc. Those are just coming up that need to be dealt with. And all kinds come up. All subtler and subtler and subtler. Sometimes you think, oh my God. But another way to think is, you know, that's all part of it. And it's part of it for all beings also. We've been going through the samsara for a really long time, you know. And so that patience is what, that patience is the patience, the patience of love, really, or the patience of gratitude, or the patience of just appreciating the rhythm, Bhagavan's rhythms, and the time zone that the creation works in, and recognizing that you're part of the creation. And the resolution, really, that what we call moksha, is once you are able to welcome all of the stuff that comes, then your buddhi, rooted in yourself, knows how to deal in a kind way with all of the stuff that comes, you know. You start to just enjoy your knowledge. You really enjoy your knowledge because you're not putting, you know, kind of the Western American, whatever, perfectionism onto yourself, which is just an awful thing, actually. Mm-hmm. You know? Like, for me to be, how am I going to be a good person? Like, am I good enough? You know? Am I spiritual enough? Am I saintly enough? You know? Do I have enough antakarana shuddhi? I don't think I'm doing that well. That's just self-involvement. With Ishvara, if you have Ishvara involvement, you can actually appreciate your growth and everybody's growth. We're all growing. It's not going to stop. The growth doesn't stop. Even for Swamiji, who you can't even imagine the nishta and his beauty, you know. But he's told me several times, you know, I keep learning. And how to handle people and how to handle difficult situations. He said, it's amazing. Mm-hmm. He said, learning never stops. So what if you have in your mind, learning is going to stop when I'm pure. Learning stops, you know. No. It can't stop. It cannot stop. It will not stop. Because to stop, you have to be Ishvara. This upadhi has alpajnaha. It has, by nature, limited knowledge. Bhagavan has limitless knowledge, where everything is known, because the whole maya upadhi as such, we're running all the way through it. So the whole thing is known. Every aspect of it is known. How is that going to happen for us? How can you be a master of every situation? You are a master of what? You know, there's even this beautiful verse. It's actually in Bhandarkar, which is the Bhagavad Gita, which is the Sanskrit book. In the second book, there's this beautiful little verse. I don't remember the Sanskrit, but I remember what it says. It's like, you have to watch out. Be careful of the pundit. A pundit is somebody who is a master, has mastery in a certain subject matter. Now, some panditjam, a pundit, a scholar, somebody who has mastery of something. Watch out for the pundit. Because having mastery in one area, they get confused and think that they have mastery in all areas. You have a mastery in one area, you know? Not in all areas. In some areas, you're completely ignorant. In many areas, you don't even know they exist. You don't even know about those areas. So this is, I mean, it's a wonderful, it's just a beautiful verse. The verse kind of shocked me and I realized the truth of it, you know? And Swamiji used to kind of talk about this because he, with the Vedanta, the level of mastery and of Sanskrit and even of chanting and everything was just so profound. But then people would ask him some question about, you know, aerodynamics or something, you know, or politics, you know, or what should we do in this case, you know, as though Swamiji would know, you know, that he's supposed to know that, as though he has hidden inside of himself Ishwara's buddhi of all knowledge, and so whatever you hit him with, you know, he should be able to tell you what is the right thing in this situation. He has no clue about that situation. All he can do is, with his wonderful objectivity, you know, talk to you about it. But that sarvajñatvam is not there. So now, do you think that for you to be a great mahatma, you have to have sarvajñatvam, this omniscience, in reference in and mastery in how to handle all the situations that come your way? You know? There's two words that we have that are, I think, important, useful, that differentiate Ajnani from Ishwara. One is, if we put the two words like this, Ishwara has both sarvajñatvam and also, what's the word, something like vidvatvam. He has all knowledge, and the vidvatvam, this is in the Mundaka, one of the last verses of the second book, I believe. He has all knowledge in general, and he has all knowledge in particular. That's Ishwara. The Mahatma, the one who has self-knowledge, has all knowledge in general. I am Brahman, this is Mithya. You know, I am the Advayananda, and all of this is Maya. In general strokes, it's all absolutely clear. It's the same vision as Ishwara, for Ishwara. But the Vidvatvam, the particular knowledge, isn't going to be there. He would have to have an infinite upadhi to have that, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. And so maybe we expect ourselves to handle every situation appropriately. Mm-hmm. That's not going to be true. It's not going to be true. But there's the general way of handling every situation. Handling every situation, you know, not being bound by raga dvesha, you know? By our likes and dislikes. You know, having non-binding likes and dislikes. Because I know that the ananda of myself is not projected on, it's just being projected on the world if I'm running after that. There's no reason to do that. So if they use the heaven example in the Bhagavad Gita, let me walk into the middle of the river to get water out of the well. It's in the middle of the river for when the summer comes and the water dries, then you have a chance of having water in that well. But now the river is flowing, so let's go to the well to get the water. There's absolutely no reason for that. And so there's no reason for me to have things a particular way. It's much easier for me to be with the way things are and respond to them in an objective way, rather than say, no, they have to be this way for me to be happy. Yeah. That falls off. You know? But those are the big strokes. But there's a lot of little learning to do. And even learning how to be with my mind and some of the surprises it throws up and some of the unconscious material it throws up, sometimes I have to sit with that and be with that and learn. Mm-hmm. So being able to slow down like that, to let this body, mind, sense organs belong to Ishwara's time. Let it unfold. Let it be part of Ishwara. You know, and let me deal with it as such, like that. In Ishwara's time, let me appreciate it and learn, you know. Then life becomes really, really beautiful. We don't want to superimpose our perfectionism onto a limited upadhi. It's very problematic. And then you won't be a real person either because you're trying too hard. Trying to be a perfect person that you think you're supposed to be, which is not possible. Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti 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 Harih Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harih Om.